Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Binall of BinallofAmerica.com with another edition of Binall of America Audio Season 2. It is October 21st, 2006. This week, we go down a road less traveled here on Binall of America Audio. We'll be discussing The Afterlife with Dennis Spaulding, co-author of My Search for the Afterlife, A Trail of Clues. What really appealed to me about Dennis Spaulding from reading his book is that he is pretty much just like you or me. He's just an average person who was plunged into the world of the esoteric. He's not out there saying that he has all the answers. He's out there saying he's searching for the answers, and here is what he has found throughout his search. So I really appreciate and enjoy that kind of perspective on the afterlife, and that's why I wanted to bring Dennis on the show. We're going to be talking about his story, how it started, how it evolved, what he believes to be numeric codes used by his son as a form of communication, animal messages, dreams and visions, mediums, medium workshops, and of course, tons and tons more. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Dennis Spaulding, let me give you a little bit of background on him. Dennis Spaulding is a former government air traffic controller who retired and moved into the private sector of air traffic control, settling in the Pacific Northwest in the Seattle metropolitan area. He's the father of four children, one of whom, Sean, passed away in early 1993. His book, My Search for the Afterlife, A Trail of Clues, is the result of that devastating effect when a parent loses a child. After a few years, he became determined to find his son in the afterlife. He kept a log throughout his journey. What he found during his search, and continues to find on a regular basis, has turned his life around and allowed him to find what he perceives to be his purpose in life. His website is www.mysearchfortheafterlife.com. Without any further ado, this interview was recorded on August 16, 2006. Dennis Spaulding on Binall of America Audio, Season 2. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Binall of America Audio. My guest this week is Dennis Spaulding. He is the author of My Search for the Afterlife, A Trail of Clues. And it is an amazing story. Sadly, his son passed away, and then over the course of about 10 years or so, he developed a theory that turned into the story that is My Search for the Afterlife. We're going to dig all into it, but the best thing I can say about the book is it's fantastic, and when I received the book, I opened the package and had left it on the kitchen table after I opened it and looked through the stuff, and I go up to get it the next day, and it's already gone. My mother has taken the book, she read the book, she loved the book, and she never reads any of the books from the Binall of America Audio guests, so that's about as good an endorsement as you can possibly get. And the book, again, is My Search for the Afterlife, A Trail of Clues. Dennis Spaulding is the author, and he's our guest this week on Binall of America Audio. Welcome to the show, Dennis.
Thank you, Tim. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Well, let's start out a little bit with your bio, your background. What was your life like before your story began here, this Search for the Afterlife story?
Grew up in a typical family. Started out in the Methodist Church with my parents every day, every Sunday. I'd rather go out and play baseball and football, but every Sunday morning found me in church. Well, as I grew up through the years, my preference in church kind of changed. As I got into my high school years, I went from the Methodist belief into the Baptist belief, helped out at summer camp. As I went on and went into the military, and I met my first wife, which is my son's mother, I converted to the Catholic faith. And then, unfortunately, we did go through a divorce about after 5 years of marriage, and through another lady I had met, I went through the Lutheran faith, and finally, kind of back into the Catholic faith, you know, right before my son had died. What I'm getting at on that is just, I've been through the gamut of religions, and when you face, you know, the death of a child, the religions weren't doing it for me.
Yeah.
And my background, work background, basically, right after high school, 3 days after high school, I went into the Marine Corps. I was in the Marine Corps for about 4 years. I lost a lot of friends during the Vietnam War. I had orders 3 times to go to Vietnam, and for some reason, each time, it was canceled. It wasn't I didn't want to go. It was, I guess, God had a reason for me. And everybody believes as you grow up, there's a purpose in life, and what's your purpose in life? You know, what is it? You're spending years trying to find that out. Well, it took the death of my son to find out what my purpose in life is. I am not a medium. I'm not a psychic. I don't profess to be. I am a father that lost a son, and I've told a story. And I've got a story to tell that I believe can help people that have lost a child. And I've got an ongoing story of something that happened this year after the book has come out that shows and tells me my journey is ongoing. I have something else now that can help people that have lost a child that never made it into this world. So I've been lucky enough to find out what my purpose in life is, and I think that's why God kept me around during the Vietnam War era to do this. After I got out of the military, I went to work for the airlines, did a lot of traveling around the world, around the countries, around the states. I did that for about 7 years. Then I moved into air traffic control with the government. Spent about 21 years in service with the government as an air traffic controller. Served basically back in Ohio. I started out Indiana. Then I moved to the West Coast. Then eventually went overseas to Pago Pago, American Samoa. I should also say Sean's mother was from Trinidad down in the Caribbean. So I spent about 19 months living down there. So I've been a lot of unique places. And when I came back from Pago Pago, back to Klamath Falls, Oregon, that's where I received the word that my son was killed in 1993. And so from that point, after moving out of Klamath Falls in 1995, we came up to the Seattle area, where I spent another 2 years at one of the airports up here as air traffic control for the government. Then I decided it was time to retire from the government. But 3 days later, I'm doing the same type of a job as of today in air traffic control with a contractor.
Yeah.
But I'm able to receive my government pension and move on from there.
Nice.
But what I'm trying to do right now is the success of this book, once that has climbed the charts, then I'm free to give up this air traffic control. My wife will be free to give up her job, and we can travel across the country and telling our story and helping as many people as we can. That's kind of my background.
Nice, nice. Okay. So from what I gather from the story, after your son passed away, about 4 years later, you started to take a keen interest in the afterlife and afterlife communication, and that's sort of when you started to discover what you call the numbers theory in the book?
Yeah, basically, all through my life, I've always felt, even as a kid, right growing up, there's something happening right next to you. There's another world going on.
Yeah.
It's either spinning too fast, spinning too slow. You can't see it, but it's there, and I've always sensed that. Well, needless to say, when you lose a child, it's the worst thing. It's like someone rips into your heart, pulls it right out, the earth opens up and swallows you, and you just don't want to face life anymore.
Yeah.
But it took about 4 to 5 years for me to finally decide I want to face the ghosts of the past and find my son. So I basically turned to spirituality. My two best friends turned out to be the library and the bookstores.
Yeah.
I read as many books as I could on spirituality, and I came across a lady, famous lady on TV. She's always on Montel Williams' show now. Her name is Sylvia Brown.
Yeah.
Well-known psychic medium. Started reading a lot of her books and practicing a lot of her meditation techniques. And as it turns out, those meditative techniques and everything I was, you know, practicing has now built up my psychic and spiritual awareness. And not knowing at the time, but that's what it developed.
Yeah.
And so that went on for about 4 or 5 years, and I kept thinking I'm getting closer and closer and closer to contacting my son.
Yeah.
Well, several years later, in 2002, let me just backpedal a little bit. I retired from the government in 1997, and that's when I decided to come out of the shell. My son died in 1993, so that's about 4 years, and I came out of the shell, started my spiritual training in about 1997.
Yeah.
So for 5 years until 2002, one of my associates where I work mentioned a gentleman that was coming on the TV scene called John Edward,
yeah,
crossing over with John Edward. And I said, no, I'm sorry. I'm going to find my son through Sylvia Brown. I basically had tunnel vision, but I didn't want to drift from the path I was on because I kept feeling stronger and stronger that with all of my meditation and everything I'm doing, mm-hmm, I'm going to eventually find my son. Well, one day, I was channel surfing at home. Right before going to bed, my wife was out in the kitchen doing something. And all of a sudden, the program pops on, John Edward crossing over. I started looking at that. And I yelled for my wife to come in here. Well, John does his his communication a little bit different. Sylvia's like a psychic medium, gives information for the past, future, basic things like that. John's a medium. A medium is a go-between between the spirit world and this world, and he passes messages. Well, I was just awestruck watching the program, and I was at a fork in the road now, a little psychic crossroad, that I knew this gentleman or this way is going to bring my son and I together. So I started reading all of John's books and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And one of the books that he was part of was by two professors out of the University of Arizona called the Afterlife Experiments.
Yeah.
And these two professors wanted to prove the afterlife truly existed. And in order to do this, to prove their theory, their thesis, they had to use the four top mediums they felt across the country were going to help them prove this. And the four mediums were John Edward, George Anderson, Suzanne Northrup, and Lori Campbell. And all of their tests and everything had to be double-checked, triple-checked, quadruple-checked, and everything, because their careers are going to be put on the line once they publish this.
Yeah.
Well, I found the book amazing. And also, all I wanted after reading that was a reading from one of these mediums.
Yeah, yeah.
I says, wow, this is something. Well, most of my communication with my son is intuitive. I sense, I feel, I'm drawn, I'm pulled to do something.
Yeah.
And after reading this book one week, about a week later, I'm just drawn to pick it up, and I go to the back for some reason. Then all of a sudden, I see the websites for these mediums. And Suzanne Northrup comes right to mind, right out of the forum, jumps right out. And I'm right on the computer to her website, and I'm drawn to the calendar. I hit that. Boom, she's coming to Seattle where I live 3 months later.
Nice.
And before my brain catches up with what my hand is doing, I'm already ordering tickets. Lady's coming on the phone, yes, how many? I said, oh, you know, I'm ordering tickets. So now I was at work on my break doing that, so I was anxious to get home, tell my wife what's going on, that all of the stuff we had seen on television, John Edward, we have never done this live. It was always a gallery. John Edward always had a gallery reading, or he would do phone readings or one-on-one readings.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't have an idea what this seminar was all about. I mean, common sense tells you what a seminar is, but when you're dealing in the psychic world, anything's possible.
Exactly.
So I wasn't sure, but I got home that night. My wife comes home. I'm excited. I said, guess what? In 3 months, we're going to go to a seminar. We're going to actually be in the audience and be live with this stuff. And I was just excited. Yeah. I couldn't sleep all night long. I was trying to think, okay, what am I supposed to do to get the attention of this person? What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to ask the questions, sit in the front row, and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
Well, I go to work the next day, and I'm on my break. And I remember the girl that told me about John Edwards said his show comes on about this time. So I turn on the television, and show comes on, and there's John Edwards starting out as normal. But then he says, well, today we're going to show you something different. I'm going to take you back to a seminar I did in Salt Lake City and show you how you get a reading. He answered every question I had the previous night. My jaw dropped open.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. And so I knew something was going on in my life at this time that I couldn't explain. Mm-hmm. So I fast forward 3 months. Suzanne Northrup is coming to town. Now, for some reason, she was going to be in Seattle on a Monday. Now, this is a week before, and I'm getting to where the number theory developed.
Okay.
I get pulled to the computer again, to her website, and I pull it up, and, well, it shows she's coming a week early to do radio shows and talk shows. This wasn't on the website before when I ordered tickets.
Yeah.
So I go, wow. So I take down the information, and my plan at the time was, since my wife works past the air times of these radio shows and that, I was just going to tape them, the TV show and also the radio interview, for her to get an idea, and also myself, of what this lady sounds like, how she delivers her messages, something to just prepare us for the following week.
Yes.
Well, on the day of the radio show, I got the tape in there, ready to tape, sit back and listen. The disc jockey goes, well, Suzanne's going to be with us here in about 10 minutes. Anybody has lost a loved one, here's the number to call if you want to try to connect. Once again, there goes my hand without my brain knowing. And it's like I meant to get through. It just rings. The guy says, hi, have you lost a loved one? I said, yeah. You want to know his name? They go, no. You wait for Suzanne to call your name and start talking. So I said, okay. Well, I waited on the phone, and I could hear the whole radio show going on for 25 minutes. Now, before I get into the number theory, let me tell the people what it is. It involves when my son passed over, which is March 14th, 1993. So it's 3/14/93. Mm-hmm. If you write that down. It also involves when he was born, 9 for September, the 24th, 68.
Yep.
Now, there's also a couple other numbers, 29, which is the last time together we were at his sister's 21st birthday party in Reno, Nevada. Him and I played roulette constantly, and we always played the number 29. And there's a story with that on the television. And the other number is 39, which represents Sean's name in the 26-letter alphabet. Mm-hmm. It totals 39, S-E-A-N. So anyhow, I am sitting there waiting, and all of a sudden the disc jockey goes, and now we have Dennis on the line. And Suzanne Arthur goes, "Hi, Dennis, who do you want to talk to?" And I said, "My son." Now, as I said that, you know, air traffic controller, you're supposed to be able to do multi-talented things. So I wrote down the time. It was 8:36 in the morning. So I wrote 8:36.
Yep.
Then I did a backslash, and I wrote 24-9 as another way of saying it, mm-hmm. 24 minutes to 9. Well, she connected with my son. It was phenomenal. I was shaken from, you know, head to foot, hair rising all over. Now, she did have some misses, which when I taped this, my wife and I also noticed that, well, she talked about, well, you must have loved to go fishing because he's showing me a fishing pole and things like that. Well, I never fished. I fished once when I was a kid, and I used wieners as bait, and I wound up eating them going home. But we went skiing, and I took him out for his first skiing thing and broke his leg and took him back to his mom and said, well, sorry. But as I learned, as my story went on and my book went on, when a spirit is coming through to talk to his father, the medium doesn't know what had happened prior. In other words, I divorced his mom, I remarried, and he had a brother, you know, through the marriage, you know, through my new wife. Mm-hmm. But his mom also remarried at the same time I did and had a brother.
Yes.
Well, his message was twofold. In other words, it wasn't for me. It was for his other dad, his stepdad. But the medium didn't know this. He just knows it's a spirit coming through for the father. And I didn't figure that portion out until probably months later or something like that. But it's talked about in the book.
Yeah.
Okay, so anyhow, the disc jockey kind of wanted us to get off. He had more people to do, so it's only about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And so a lot more stuff went on this week before the actual seminar took place the following week. We went to the seminar on that Monday. Nothing happened. However, we got to see firsthand and feel firsthand what they can do and what they can bring to people and the connection they can make. And it just draws you into this. And you're just so emotional. You're not getting a reading, but maybe the guy behind me, who it was, he was an older gentleman.
Yeah.
But, oh, the tears in my eyes and everything. But when we walked out, my wife was a little bit disappointed because we didn't get a reading, but we fell back on the one 4 days earlier from the radio. I said, we still have that. So
yeah.
She goes, yeah, we are lucky to have that. The very next day I was off. She was at work. I started playing the radio interview once again. Just a lot of times you miss something.
Yeah.
And I'm looking down at the numbers I wrote, 8:36/24-9. And then my eyes caught it. I went backwards, right to left. I read 9/24/68. That's when he was born. And I looked at the 3 and the 9 in the formula. I said, 3, 9. Well, 39 meaning Sean, 3 representing March, you know, for the month, and 93 for the year he died. I'm going, wow. That is strange. And I started thinking, I wonder. That was the initial start of my number theory. And like I tell everybody I talk with, this theory is for me.
Yeah.
It's something I came up with that means something to me, that my son is trying to communicate, you know, through that way. The only thing I didn't have there was this biggest number of my story, the 14, which is the actual day he died. Now, some people say, well, why doesn't he just communicate you with showing you 14s? Why this complicated stuff? I said, I don't know. Go ask the spirit world.
Yeah.
You know, I says, I can only go by what I feel, what I sense when a lot of things happen.
Yeah.
And our communication isn't always numbers. There's things like butterflies, license plate. But finding my son, this number theory had a whole lot to do with it. Now, about a month later, my brother came to town, and he found the missing 14 for me in a simple theory, in a simple number, you know, little theory thing.
Yeah.
I won't give that away over there. They can see that in the book.
Exactly.
But we were watching John Edward, probably about a month after that, after the phone interview with Suzanne, and I kind of look over at my wife. It's on a break from the program. And I says, you know, it would have been good if Suzanne would have told me what Sean and our special number was. That would have been a good validation to prove that, yes, she really is talking with Sean. She goes, yeah. And I says, well, you don't even remember what it is. She goes, yes, I do. She said, when we were in Reno, you and him played roulette all the time, the number 29. And not more than 5 seconds after she said that, we got a large TV in our living room we were looking at. That screen filled up with the biggest 29 number I have ever seen, with a 95 up in the right-hand corner. They were advertising some product. We have never seen it on TV to this day, and it's been, what, 4 years now or something?
Yeah.
And the hairs, I think, just stood in. I look over at my wife, and I just go, did you see that? She goes, yeah. And so I talked to my son then. I said, thanks, son, for letting me know your hair. I'm, you know, glad you're around watching.
Yeah.
And the 95, if you add that together, makes a 14.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the start of how the number things develop. And it just got more things, more intriguing things would happen with newspapers arriving or newsletters arriving or this, or rooms I'm placed in at hotels or things like that, where it just a simple thing to tell people, two things I can that are simple. 314, March 14th. I belong to a Scottish Highlander clan called Clan Murray. I'm a Spalding, so I'm a sept of that. And I help run our tents when we go to these Highlander events. Well, there was an event that was going to take place several hours north of Seattle. It was a one-day event on a Saturday. Now, we didn't want to drive up Saturday morning to help put up the tent, you know, and then have the function that day and come home. So we chose to go up a day early, spend the night at a hotel, and have dinner. And we went up with our clan commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 3 months before that, I made my hotel reservation. I says, we're going to arrive early. I don't want to wait till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I want to be able to get my room probably about 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
That's the only request I made.
Mm-hmm.
The day before leaving, I start talking with my son, Sean. I says, hey, you never saw your dad wearing a kilt in real life. Why don't you come on up, laugh if you want, laugh at me in the kilt, listen to the bagpipes, watch the dancing girls. We'll have a good time. Well, we arrive at the hotel. Walk in, check in. He says, yes, Mr. Spalding, I got your room all ready for you. And he hands me a key. And I look at it, and I must have blurted out some noise or something because it shocked me. He goes, if that's, you don't like that, I got plenty of other rooms to give you. I said, that'll work just fine. It was room 314. What better way for my son to say, hi, Dad, I'm here. Let's go have fun.
Yeah.
Another simple one that was not in the book. This happened right after the book came out, and this is going to be in book number 2. This happened last year in October. The movie Just Like Heaven was released last year, and this starred Reese Witherspoon, and I think it was Mark Ruffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened, she was like a doctor and supposedly died, and finally her relatives rent out her one-room flat in a very, you know, prestigious neighborhood.
Yeah.
Well, this guy gets it. Well, she comes back haunting him, not realizing, you know, the way the story goes, that she may be dead.
Yeah.
And it was a love-hate relationship, a comedy thing. Really, really good, really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for the story now, my son is buried in Warrior, Alabama, where his mother lives. She wanted him close to her back in Alabama, and I'm in Seattle, and I had no problems with that. And once again, he also died in March. So, as we're walking out, my wife notices a car sitting in front of ours and says, look at that car. It's got Alabama license plates. And I go, oh, really? So like anything, I take notes. I'm an avid note taker now.
Yeah.
And tuck that away. The very next day, we went out to the fairgrounds. This is the next day. And they were having an Oktoberfest out at the local fairgrounds. So we went out there, had a good time. We're coming back. I start to get in the car, and then I pause a second, and I remember the day before. So I purposely walk around my car, look at the car next to us, and sure enough, there's another car with Alabama license plates, and it's got an expiration tag for March. Now, to me, that was my son giving me another sign that said, "Hi, Dad, enjoy the movie about heaven, love the fair, see you later." That wasn't basically a number theory. That was tied with, you know, license plates and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing type of a communication. And what I can tell people is once you can tune in psychically and spiritually of how your loved ones are trying to communicate with you, it's one of the best things in life you can feel. I mean, you can once again rejoin your family, your sons, and the times when you're feeling low, when one of these little signs comes to you that they're around you and they're watching you and they're there, it just can, you know, the mood just changes and you're just happy all again and so forth. So it's really fantastic.
Now, since the publication of your book and obviously the work that you were doing before came out, have you heard from any other people or have you discovered any other folks who have their own sort of number connection to a deceased loved one? Are you not alone in this sort of scenario?
Since the book has come out, during our advertising stuff, I've gone to the military bases here up in the Seattle area. I was trying to do that once a month here, but now with my schedule, stuff like that, I have to do about every 2 months. And I set up a kiosk card at one of the local malls up here. And I was doing that about once every month. And now I've had to cut back a little bit because of my other job to maybe once every 3 months.
Yeah.
And every so often, people will come back to me and tell me their own number theories or basic things like that.
Mm-hmm.
In my book, I talk about a lady that I met at the John Edward seminar, my very first seminar for John. We talked for about 5.5 hours waiting in line. We told stories about our son. She lost a son in the military also. And his favorite number, their special number, was the number 11. Well, when it came time for my book, I got permission to tell our little story about this. And when I sent the book to her after it came out, she wrote me a very quick email. She thanked me for writing about her son in the book. She says, "The only thing that I was disappointed in when I got the book," she says, "was you did not have the story about my son in chapter 11, you know, since that was our special number."
Yeah.
And I had to explain to her, you know, once I responded to that email, that my book is in chronological order. When the events happen, that's what I call them. These things, I call them events in my life. Mm-hmm. When they happen, it's written when they happen. I can't put something out of context, as, you know, to put it here in chapter 11 when I'm talking about it in chapter 9 or something like
that.
Well, her original email went on. She said, "Well, I put your book down, and I went on to finish my housework." And she says, "While I'm vacuum cleaning, I kept hearing in my mind, 'Check the numbers, Bob. Check the numbers.'" She says, "I couldn't figure out what it meant." She says, "I shut off the vacuum. I walked back to the desk. I picked up your book, and I went back to Brian Paul's story. And I'm reading it again. It's on pages 113 and 114 in my book." And she says, "And there it was right in front of me." She says, "If you add page 113, 113, and 114, 114, you add those six numbers together, it comes to 11. She says, "It was right there. That was Brian Paul with a big number 11, you know, with a big hello and thanking me." So she wrote back several more times about other experiences where she lives in Salt Lake City, where Brian has said hello to her through numbers and basic things like that, or leaving coins by them in the middle of the supermarket when they were going somewhere. So she has relayed a lot of stories. And there's been several people that have come back and told me about numbers in their life. So, yes, to answer your question, it does.
Yeah, so maybe it's pretty prevalent. Maybe some folks haven't really caught on to it yet, too.
Right.
Talk a little bit about the blue butterfly aspect of your story. Leave some for the readers also, you know, but talk a little bit about that, because that's pretty significant, too, in that it's sort of perhaps a connection here with an earthly sort of creature showing themselves.
Right. Basically, the blue butterfly right now means to me that Sean is around. And other people that have seen the blue butterfly, like when I was on a contact radio program, I was contracted on there for about 9 interviews. Mm-hmm. And during one of the interviews, he came in and says, you know, ever since you talked about that story on air, that's all I've been seeing. Your son has been showing me this and this and this and different things. And I said, yeah, that's just his basic way of saying, hi, I'm around. And from a recent reading that I've gotten now from a shaman or another medium who has Indian heritage in him, he's up in British Columbia, he says, we have now gone from the butterfly to the dragonfly. He says, that's your son's new thing now. He says, when you see the dragonfly around you, that's him coming around saying hello. But basically what had happened in the story, when I felt it was time to bring Sean's mother in on what's going on, that I was writing a book and different things going on in my life, I hadn't talked with her in probably 10 years.
Yeah.
So I called and brought her up to date. I let her hear the interview on the radio with Suzanne Northrup. And I was afraid when I called that time that, you know, I don't know what she's going to think or what's going on, but she was very receptive. But the reader's going to find out how that story goes. Her being real receptive turned out to bite me in the butt, so to speak, months down the line, because I don't know if it was something going on in her life. I don't know if her and her husband were having a problem, you know, with this,
yeah.
Because it had been so long since Sean had been had died. Maybe it's opening old wounds. I never knew. But after our talk, she said every time she visited Sean's gravesite in a cemetery, there is always, almost always, a blue butterfly that flew around. And she says she felt that was her son, Shawnee, she liked to call him. That was his way of saying, hi, Mom, I'm in a happier place and I'm doing just fine. Well, after hanging up the phone and then having, you know, wrote about this, I put a little thing in there that says, well, when I see the blue butterfly in the Pacific Northwest, then I'm going to know my son's out here around me. Now, some people accuse me and they say, well, you can find anything you want if you're looking. You can make something out of nothing or find whatever it is that you want to verify or validate whatever it is you're talking about.
Yeah.
I says, that's true. I says, but my blue butterfly story shows I wasn't searching for it. It found me. So 13 months later, after this phone call, I'm on my way home from work and I drive into a Starbucks and get out. As I'm walking up to the store, I see these two college-age females outside having a talk. One is, her back is to me with her midriff bared, and there is a giant blue tattooed butterfly. I admit, yes, now I am looking, searching, and I do see that butterfly. And my first thing out of my mouth is, good afternoon, son. Glad to see you. I walk in the store, get my normal Starbucks drink. Out here in Seattle, it's very popular.
I bet.
You know, oh yeah, every morning I have to have my two-shot Americana, yada, yada, yada. So anyhow, I come walking out, the girls are gone. I go, wow. So, to me, that's an event.
Yeah.
I go home, and I go, when did I talk with Sean's mom about this? I look up my notes in the book, and I talk with her in February on the 26th the previous year. Well, this is March 26th, 13 months later. And I go, wow, there's something. Well, needless to say, like I said, you wanted to say something for the reader. The following month, something else happens, and the month after that. And what happens is, after this event happened, the numbers play a very interesting scenario on here that validates more towards my number theory. Let me play it that, or say it that way.
Yeah, yeah. The blue butterfly and the numbers theory sort of coincide.
Blue butterfly, numbers, they all kind of come together and make people go, like my worst critic, married to my daughter. His one thing that I treasure, he didn't believe everything I said.
Mm-hmm.
But as my book started going on, more writing, more of this, I always shared my information when things happen. And he looked at me one day, he says, you know, I don't necessarily believe it. He says, I'm not saying those are lies or nothing, but you have something going on in your life I can't explain. you know, is very interesting. But I can't explain it. There's too many things going on for people to say that's a coincidence.
Yeah.
You know, when you've got a book that thick and you're on another book, that's not coincidence anymore. And I know that, having, you know, studied under Suzanne Northrup and these other mediums and that, that there's no such thing as coincidence. Everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
So.
Talk a little bit about the importance of dreams to your story, because in a lot of times dreams happen to you and they sort of open up clues towards more investigation for you.
Well, dreams have always, I started writing down a lot of dreams sometimes, and sometimes I can't explain it, and other times they're just so real, and a lot of times it would happen right after I have a meditative session, maybe the day before, maybe 2 days before that. I would wind up having these, like, powerful dreams of whether it was my son, Sean, or my brother that passed away, different things like that. It was just like, you know, just so real. And I remember from some readings with mediums that I have had, my older brother, well, he likes visiting early in the morning, they say. And that's when I remember him appearing in some of my dreams. And what I also did to put the dreams together with my number theory, I started doing a test, because the reason I did the test, I found myself waking up at certain times during the middle of the night, and I would look at the clock to see what time it was. And what got me going on this test was, like, one time I woke up at 3:14 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, wow,
yeah,
is that my son saying he's around me? So I started a one-week test and documented all of the times I woke up during the night for, I think it was about 5 or 6 days. And each time the numbers came out that fit within my theory. And since I'm 6 years old, sometimes I go to bed at 8 o'clock at night. I'm lucky if I stay up to 9:30. But this one night, the final day of my test, it was like I woke up at 39 minutes after midnight. And to me, like I said, 39 represents my son's name. That's why I called the book, my second book that's coming out, Messages from the Next World, His Signature. I'm showing his signature now as 39. That represents his name. And when I saw that, that was like my son saying, okay, Dad, your test is over. Sean signing out.
Yeah.
You know, rather than his name, Sean, he just gives me a 39, says, okay, that's over. You've had a week of tests or whatever it was. You know, have I proved to you of what you thought about? So that's kind of my, you know, my take on that.
Yeah. Now, at what point throughout this whole process did you go from thinking, you know, this is interesting, to like being, wow, there really is something to this? Like, was there a specific point where you were like, that you became a believer, for lack of a better term?
My believing point came when I decided to find my son. And that started with Sylvia Brown. I was a believer at that point because I had always felt there was something beyond what we're taught here. All through my religions, I have always questioned. I do not stand there or sit there and listen to somebody tell me this is how it is without a question.
Yeah.
And if they can't answer the question, well, you know, I just don't take something at face value, you know. And so when I made that choice that I wanted to find my son, I was a believer at that point. And now I had to do what I had to do, whatever it would take to find him. And all of the reading and, like I said, the spiritual and the psychic awareness and the meditation and everything I was doing was building my inner self to be able to, you know, once again, make this reunion with my son. And the book is written in two parts. It's my journey to find him. And the number clues was the main thing that happened during that time. And after our reunion, so to speak, in the book, chapter two is now our story together of letting other people realize that your loved ones are around you. I talk about a lot of mediums in my book. I go to a lot of mediums now, but these are ones that, not the shysters, these are the ones, you know, the hardcore, the good mediums. And the reason I continue to go there is my son and I always speak as our, like it's our story, our book, our website. because we want to help people. And if I can be in a position to get a message from a medium to somebody that I know, I will be the messenger. I will pass that on. Now, I can't say what they're going to do once they receive this.
Yeah.
But I will be the messenger, pass on the information, and then, you know, go from there.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure you've had your run-ins with the critics and the skeptics. So what do you say to the people who are just non-believers who say, you know, that you're looking into it too much, or you're, you know, anybody can find number connections, and if you look at the numbers long enough and all that, that sort of stuff. I'm sure you've heard it all. So what do you say to those, the critics and the skeptics out there?
I says, yes, on the number theory, like you're saying, oh, yeah, people can make anything out of numbers. But when you look at how it comes down to, in my life, representing, you know, the what I told you about, when he was born, when he died, yes, I agree. Anything can be made out of anything. However, I fall back on my analogy. I say, let's say Seattle, Washington, where I live, that's heaven. Everybody's trying to get there. When I'm at my kiosk cart, the born-again Christians come up to me and say, no, there's only one way of getting there. You got to this, 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 and this, and this, and this. And I don't argue. I say, well, that's your belief. I says, I believe there's many roads to heaven. I says, if I was in Seattle, I says, I don't care how a born-again Christian gets to Seattle. If it was I-5 South, one of our major highways, that's how you get there. That's fine. If the Catholics want to come I-5 North, the Protestants want to come Interstate 90 from the east, the Jehovah Witnesses want to come, you know, Interstate 90 from the west. I says, if everybody makes it to Seattle, I'm a happy camper. I do not choose to judge how that person gets there. I says, but when you boil it all down, no matter what religion you're talking about, or my belief in the spiritual issue, the number theories, it's a belief. It's a six-letter word, belief. It floats your boat. It gets you through the killings, the wars of everything going on. But it's a belief, and you will not know until the day you die what's right. I said, I cannot believe that there's a God that will punish you and you will be in eternal damnation because I didn't believe the way you wanted to believe as a born-again Christian. I didn't believe the way you wanted to believe as a devout Catholic. And I says, a belief is exactly what that word means. It's a belief. And you believe 100, 150, 200% your belief is correct. Well, I feel the same way. My belief now of what I've learned is correct, and I will go to the grave with that. And the day I die is when my eyes will open and I will know, oh, wow, that's how it is. Maybe I'm right. Maybe I'm wrong. But I'll find out. And that's what everybody will find out on the day they die also. That's kind of the way I answer it.
Okay.